I'm joined on the line right now with Andalusia Knoll, who is a freelance journalist based in Mexico City, who just recently got back from Brazil, where she was covering the World Cup and the resistance movement against it, which we'll be talking about today as we approach the World Cup final this weekend. And of course, Brazil playing Germany today, a game that a lot of people are going to be watching, and perhaps maybe fewer people paying attention to the resistance movements happening in Brazil. So first of all, Andalusia, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So as we approach the final of the World Cup and the wrap-up of the World Cup this weekend, can you tell us a little bit about, give us a sense of what's been happening in the streets, and is there still an ongoing movement of resistance against the World Cup in Brazil?
Sure. Well, I think it's important to know that there are protests happening, and they're happening all over Brazil, because the World Cup was happening in 12 cities across the country. You know, it's an enormous country and very spread out, the locations of the games, and that there were almost every time that there was a game, there were protests taking place in the streets. One thing is that this really wasn't hitting the media. You know, I think the media wanted to paint the picture that, oh yeah, these people, you know, they were a little annoyed last year, but now everyone's really happy. The World Cup has started. Brazil loves football, and everything's fine. But that's really not the case. There really are, you know, people that are really fed up with the World Cup. They're fed up with FIFA. They're fed up with corruption. They're fed up with how much money, you know, more than $11 billion was spent on the cup. You know, all the people that were displaced from their homes, for the stadiums to be built, you know, and this isn't something that, you know, went away once football started. But, I mean, you know, the games of the cup. But it is important to note that it is true that the protests were perhaps not as large as many people expected. And I don't think that's just due to the fact that people really love football and want to watch it. I think it's due to the fact that there is incredible repression of protest in Brazil. You know, so I think I arrived in time for the opening games in São Paulo. And we were heading over close to the stadium where the kickoff games were going to be. And we were just getting off the metro, and we couldn't even get out of the station without being tear gassed. So there were police standing right outside the station, shooting tear gas towards the subway station. And so, you know, then we got out, and actually there were no protesters. And at first we just found, like, there was 100 reporters looking for the protesters. I mean, and this is, you know, it's striking to see how reporters, they look like they're going into battle. All of the reporters that are covering these protesters have gas masks, have helmets. I mean, I even saw some international reporters with bulletproof vests. And so the reporters then finally, you know, we followed the march of the reporters, and we made it to where there was a protest in front of the Metro Workers Union, because the Metro Workers had been on strike leading up to the World Cup. And there was, you know, there were different, like, convergences of protesters, some that, you know, are part of the Black Bloc and have a little more confrontational style, and others who just wanted to, you know, have kind of a speak out of the World Cup. But really, the police didn't distinguish between any and just repressed everyone, you know, and fired lots of tear gas and used lots of pepper spray. And pretty much, I mean, the police look like robocops. Brazil has spent, you know, millions of dollars on security for the World Cup, and this results in a higher usage of, quote, non-lethal weapons, which we know are not actually non-lethal, you know, and that people all across the world have been killed by these non-lethal weapons, you know. And in São Paulo, last year, in the large protest in June, there was a reporter, a photographer, who was actually shot in the eye with a rubber bullet by the police and is now half blind. And so I mentioned this because it's really important to know why perhaps there aren't that many people taking to the streets. You know, most of the protests have only been a few hundred people, and I don't think it's because all of a sudden people like the World Cup. It's because they're scared of being hit in the head with a rubber bullet, which could kill them. They're scared, you know, of breathing in lots of tear gas. They're scared of being beat up, and the police also have these things called shock groups, the Grupo de Choque, where, you know, they have these big shields, and they just stand behind their shields, and they just fire whatever they want at protesters, you know? And that repression has been continuing throughout the games. It's not, this was in São Paulo, but it's been happening. I think, if I'm correct, there was in the city of Recife, which is in the north and a more a poorer city of Brazil, unlike São Paulo, which is the wealthiest city in Brazil, even though there's lots of income disparity there. There were people that were protesting against a project in the historical center, and they were also the protest was violently broken up the first day. And the list goes on and on and on. I mean, the thing that said is it's hard to find this information online because there aren't many people reporting on it. And it's also not even coming out in the Brazilian media itself.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you kind of touched on some of the social issues that protesters have been raising during the protests against the World Cup. So you talked about the displacement and the housing struggles, the labor strike of the metro workers in Sao Paulo. And we've kind of, you know, heard talk about an anti-Copa movement, an anti-Cup movement happening in Brazil. And what I'm wondering is this kind of like a unified movement that is organized around certain demands, or what is the kind of actual organizing look like on the ground there?
Sure. I mean, I could both, you know, basically speak about where I was in Sao Paulo and Rio in the month that I was there, you know, recognizing I don't have a longer history of reporting or working in the country. But in Sao Paulo, there's a lot of housing activists and also a lot of favela activists. You know, and favela is a term that is often translated to slum, which I think is an inappropriate translation, you know, which is mostly kind of informal housing or housing that was built informally and then has become, you know, more formal, that people think, oh, favela, it's a shanty town. It's not a shanty town. Usually the houses are built with brick and mortar or concrete or, you know, more substantial construction. But the thing is that they generally, favelas, lack proper sanitation. They lack proper drainage. You know, they lack a lot of social services and health and education. And so in Sao Paulo, in the days leading up to the World Cup, there was a favela right in the center of the city that organized, you know, the People's World Cup, you know, and they had people playing soccer from the favelas, you know, and they said, okay, and the World Cup is charging, you know, hundreds of dollars for their tickets, that no one here, the Brazilians, can't afford these hundreds of dollars because minimum wage in Brazil is between $310 and $330 a month. And, you know, tickets were costing up to $1,000, you know, so how is someone who makes that, doesn't even make that a month, going to buy a ticket, you know, and the minimum ticket were $90 if you got them very much in advance. So anyway, so the favela, they were organizing around the World Cup by having kind of this alternative, these alternative games, you know? And then there was also there was two housing organizations. One is a larger one, the homeless workers movement, which are somewhat related to the landless workers movement in Brazil, the MST, but this is the MTST. And they organized a big encampment very close to one of the stadiums in Sao Paulo, to put pressure on their government to provide them with housing. And that was actually a victory because there were thousands of people staying in this encampment, and they convinced the government to build more proper housing for them. And so then there's other groups who took the moment of the World Cup to highlight kind of the disparity and inequality in housing and occupy a luxury building in downtown Sao Paulo. So I covered this action where actually as the first game was starting, they entered this building with a few hundred activists, some who are members of Passe Libre, who were the ones that were organizing the protest last year against the bus fare increase, which is what had sparked the huge movement in June of 2013 all across Brazil, and also some artists and then some housing activists and homeless activists, people that, you know, had nowhere else to go and were going to be living in this luxury building in downtown Sao Paulo. And the people were occupying that building there. This is a month later, and they're still there, and they're moving in more residents and trying to build kind of a permanent home, but also not just a normal home, but one, you know, with more cooperation and solidarity amongst the residents. So I think that these show kind of how people are linking housing struggles to the World Cup. And then that's in Sao Paulo, whereas in Rio, there's really... in Rio, the Janeiro is where there are a lot more housing demolitions in preparation for the World Cup. And also Rio has the double whammy because it has the World Cup in 2014 and then it has the Olympics in 2016. So this means that there's been many houses that have been destroyed for the World Cup, and then there's many more that will be destroyed for the Olympics, you know. So I actually went and visited one community that's called Villa Autodromo, and it's next to where the Olympic Park will be. And it's very interesting because it's a community of people that moved there during the 60s and 70s when there was a military dictatorship, and they were exiled from their small towns or cities because of their politics, and they came and hid out in this community and then built their lives or built their homes. And now it's a very beautiful community, and the government has already torn down half of the homes and wants to tear down the other half so they could build housing for the Olympic Games there. But the people, you know, they're saying that they won't move, but there are thousands of people, and sorry that I don't have the exact statistic, but that have already been removed from their homes, you know, and that the people being removed from their homes, the favela residents are resilient and they fight back, you know? And so people really took to the streets and they protested against their displacements. And in many of the favelas, there are militarized police, and there's a new kind of police that's called the pacification police, which was started in 2008 so that the police would have kind of a permanent presence in these favela communities, which are high incidence of drug trafficking and violence. But of course, the military police is not necessarily the right response to it. But so, you know, in many of these protests, the police would fire on people. And in these favela protests, we're not just talking about rubber bullets. The police actually use live ammunition. So these, you know, when related to the protests against the demolitions that had been happening before the World Cup, during the World Cup, actually on June 18th, it was the day that Chileans tried to, you know, break into the Maracana Stadium, and that got, you know, big news that Chileans were trying to get into the stadium. But what hardly hit the news was that there was a young man, a 25 years old, Afonso Mauricio Linares, who was actually a referee in a soccer game in a favela, and he was killed by the police, you know. And this hardly hit the news, hardly hit the Brazilian news, hardly hit the international news. And one reason is actually that police, up until a few years ago, it was estimated that police in Rio de Janeiro kill over 1,000 residents every year. So it's just something that's so commonplace that the media doesn't even think they need to report on it, and that this happened during a soccer game during the World Cup. But anyway, so in response to that, favela residents and activists took to the streets, and as there was a game, I think it was Brazil was playing on the Monday following the assassination of this young man, they took to the streets in Copacabana, which is like the ritzy beach section of Rio de Janeiro, where the fan fest was happening, where thousands of people were coming to watch the games, and said that, you know, the party in the stadiums is not worth the tears in the favelas, you know, that people can enjoy the World Cup and they could enjoy the games, but that this shouldn't lead to the suffering of the millions of residents of favelas in Rio. Mm-hmm.
Again, we're speaking with Andalusia Knoll, who is a freelance journalist who is in Brazil covering the protests against the World Cup. You can find Andalusia's reports up on her blog, which is andalalucha.tumblr.com. Andalusia, finally, a very interesting report that you put up was looking at street art and the use of art to protest against the World Cup in Brazil. Can you tell us a little bit about that movement there? What artists in the streets have been saying about this movement?
Sure. All over São Paulo and all over Rio, there is graffiti and street art against the World Cup. And so just following up on the favela protest, there has been a movement to paint soccer jerseys with the names of people that have been murdered in the favelas. And for the jersey number, they put -1. So there were 9 people that were murdered in the Mare favela, I think, last year, and they have been painting the names of these people on these soccer jerseys, you know, reminding people that about the bloodshed and the tear shed for the World Cup. And also there was one artist in São Paulo, Paulo Ito, who is a street artist and graffiti artist, who painted a picture of, you know, kind of like a famished boy eating a soccer ball. You know, he had no other food on the plate but the soccer ball, you know, really criticizing the spending of the World Cup. You know what I said, $11 billion. And this is, Brazil is one of the countries in the world that has the highest income disparity rates, you know, and really high poverty rates, much like South Africa, who hosted the last World Cup. And one thing that really caught my attention about this piece of art is that one day I was on the bus in Mexico City, which has like TV propaganda TVs in the bus, and they play really stupid news and, you know, other commercials. And they actually were playing a piece about this piece of street art, you know, and talking about criticisms of the World Cup. And it made me think that maybe without that one mural, that maybe lots of people wouldn't even know that there were criticisms of the World Cup. So I spoke with the artist, you know, and he said, oh, he thought, you know, he felt he needed to criticize the World Cup and how the money was being spent and really the lack of social service in Brazil, but he never thought that it would go viral how it did, you know. And it was funny because as I went to interview him, there was like a crew waiting from Norway, a crew waiting from Japan, a crew waiting from India, and a crew waiting from Canada, all to interview him. But I think that really speaks to the power of art and the power of street art to convey a message.
Again, we've been speaking with Andalusia Knoll, a freelance journalist based in Mexico City, who was in Brazil covering the movement against the World Cup. Andalusia, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Aaron. Thanks for having me on.